Hello, and welcome to Not Your Best Girl, a podcast with A-tier hosts and D-tier taste. My name is Kim. I use she, her pronouns.
Hi, I'm Leanne. I use she, her, hers.
And today we have what I think is a fascinating topic to talk about, and I think we'll have a really interesting discussion. But first, I wanted to say, for this episode and all episodes going forwards, please check out our description to find any content or spoiler warnings. They will all have time stamps, so feel free to skip over any particular section based on the content warnings or if you don't want to be spoiled for the show. And we'll do our best to also warn for spoilers as we're speaking and give sort of major spoiler warnings versus minor ones. And if there are any content warnings that you feel necessary for an episode, please let us know and we will happily add them. So, like every week, I want to start us off by talking about just our weekly check-in, what we've been watching, not related to our ongoing challenge. Leanne, if you want to go first, please feel free to do so. Otherwise, I can talk about Code Geass.
Sure, I'll go first. You might have like a happier note to end on. Maybe not happier, but more engaged. More engaged. So I have this horrible impulse where I decide I want to watch something either famously bad or that I know I personally will not care for every 100th anime I watch. So the first time I did this with my 100th anime, it was School Days. So that kind of sets the tone and the precedent. Now, I did this again this weekend, past weekend, with Blends, or Blend S. I don't actually quite know which is more appropriate. And it actually, the show has a decent fan base, but I could tell that it was probably going to be trash and that I would have to force myself through it eventually. And I think I was right. Blend is a 2017 workplace comedy that takes place at a themed coffee shop wherein the servers perform anime tropes. So the women will, you know, take your orders as the tsundere or the emoto or something to make the experience more akin to like a maid cafe than just grabbing coffee. I feel that the performative roles and tropes possibly was one of the stronger points of the anime because we didn't have these women being these tropes as these characters. They didn't like pre-exist as them, and they were entirely within performativity. I'll get back to that later. The story primarily revolves around Micah, who gets hired to play the sadist server. You can't see my finger quotes, but I did that. Due to her unnatural ability to come across harshly. I'm not going to say that there aren't any good things about this show. Again, I think there's value in the servers not necessarily fulfilling those common female tropes, making them performative instead. But it's counteracted by tired, unfunny, and, well, insulting humor. Think of it as worse working, which is a better workplace comedy. And personally, I am never going to be one to support an age gap romance when one of them is a high schooler and the other is an adult, especially when the adult, who the name is Dino, is also Micah's boss. And then even this secondary romance, even though it's like a potentially less icky one because the gap is less big, but still one is a high schooler and one isn't. And this does happen in a lot of anime, unfortunately, so it does kind of become a thing that doesn't necessarily make the show unwatchable for me. I just kind of roll my eyes and continue on. But the jokes are bad everywhere, the most dealable being tired tit jokes, and the worst of the jokes being steeped in transphobia. It is wild to me that this show seems to have a decent fan base. All in all, do not recommend.
Fair enough. I wasn't planning on watching it, but now I won't.
I do like the OP, though. There are things I like less now that I've seen it, but I do like the OP. I think it's the best thing about the show.
Fair enough. Fair enough. It is always easy to get on like anime quiz things.
Right.
Which I appreciate it for. This week, I watched something that I have very complicated feelings on, which is Code Geass Season 2. So I talked last week about Season 1 of Code Geass, and I didn't get too deep into it because I wanted to see how Season 2 unfolded, and also because I really would like to not spoil the show, because I think, Leanne, that you would actually enjoy a lot of the aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to try not to give major spoilers. That being said, it's hard to talk about it without giving major spoilers because a lot happens this season. What I will say is, first and foremost, I'm mad that it got more horny season one was like not that horny. Like, you know, the character designs were a little bit much and everyone had large busts, even though they really shouldn't have.
I remember Callan.
Callan is a little excessive. Like, they're all excessive, but Callan, who I love, by the way, and is arguably the best character, is her chest varies in size depending on what she's wearing. But season two just takes all of that and like ramps it up to like 11, along with like lingering shots on like characters' asses and like everybody's in crop tops. It to the point where it started to really tire me out, and I have a pretty high threshold for that kind of thing. I think you have to watch a lot of anime.
Yep.
But I have a pretty high threshold, and even I was sitting there like, I can't do this. I can't do this. But I continued on because I was really enjoying it. I think that there were a lot of complications going into the season. Since Code Geass is not based off of a manga, it's not an adaptation of anything. I know that the writer really struggled to complete this in the time that was allotted him, and it caused him a lot of stress and mental health problems. And you can see that there were ideas that seemed to be scrapped halfway through the season. The season feels like it ends at episode 21, and then there's still 4 episodes left to go through the actual ending. A lot of the plot is basically stolen from Evangelion, which is not a knock against Code Geass, because I think that a lot of anime since Evangelion have been stealing from Evangelion. But the plot of season two basically follows from the end of season one. There's a time skip. We continue to follow Lelouch as the protagonist, who is the former prince of the Britannian Empire, who is exiled to Japan after the death of his mother. And he's continuing to lead a rebellion against the Britannian Emperor, his father, under the mask of a figure called Zero. And the plot gets a lot more in-depth about what the Geass is specifically. The Geass is a power that lets him command anyone to do anything once per person. It gets a lot more into that lore, which I thought was interesting, if not perfectly done. I actually appreciated the politics of it still. Lelouch remains a really likable protagonist for the majority of this season. I think maybe some people would disagree with me, but what I think Code Geass does more strongly than any of the other shows in its genre that I could compare it to is it creates a very likable, believably high school protagonist who has suffered from a lot of PTSD and really struggled, but who also maintains a typical schoolboy persona. He like cuts class, struggles with his friends, and has a crush on a girl who he really wants to kiss him. And there are still school-based episodes and like festivals and student council shenanigans all the way up through 2/3 of the way through the season. And I think that that makes it even more impactful when it tries to do larger concept things or big sweeping character arcs. That being said, outside of the horniness, the season also hates women a lot more than season one does, which I will talk about in our later conversation. But yeah, that's kind of my complex feelings on season two of Code Geass. But overall, I really, really enjoyed it. I'm definitely going to watch the spin-off series, which is only a few episodes, and the alternate universe movies.
So, Kim, you said your feelings on the show are complex, but I have to ask another question. Under the guise of Zero, would you call Lelouch's motives complex?
Fuck! Lelouch has complex motives. Actually, the thing is, yes, I would. I would say he has pretty hashtag complex motives. Hi, welcome to We Love Zero Escape.
Did you know that snail is an anagram of slain?
Thank you, Uchikoshi, for teaching me this. These useful information. Hey, Leanne, did you know that life is just simply unfair?
Oh, man.
Which also could have been the theme of Code Geass. Life is unfair. But
and Malcolm in the Middle.
Fuck. Code Geass is like basically Malcolm in the Middle.
Thank you for coming to our podcast today.
It just has robots. Is
that was our
difference.
Deep dive.
Fuck. You know what? I'd read an essay comparing the two things. I think that would be fun. Moving forward from my aggressive feelings on Code Geass, which I will not get over and I will continue talking about, I wanted to just bring us to our next section, checking in on our current challenge, Hot Momo Summer, where we are working our way through the entire anime filmography of Mamoru Miyano. Take it away, Leanne.
Yes, as I'm looking at my notes now, I realize I forgot to write notes on one of the shows. So one show will be potentially better discussed than the other. So I am at this point a little more than halfway through Days, which is a pretty standard sports anime fare so far, about a soccer team. It's an ordinary boy, Tsukamoto, without experience, decides to go out and try for the soccer team, and gets into extraordinary circumstances that we don't quite understand because somebody believes in him, even though there were probably people who deserved to be on it. And then we watch him improve despite not being the strongest character on the team. But we are supposed to admire his spirit. There's a deuteragonist, Kazama, who is incredible at soccer but has an attitude about it. And if you've watched sports anime, we've kind of been here before. It's pretty, again, pretty standard. I'm mostly enjoying it, though, as I do mostly enjoy sports anime. A lot of the jokes and plots feel a little borrowed from better works, though. A couple of the characters are memorable, such as Kazama, and then Mamo's character, Oshiba, who also has a bit of an attitude. Frankly, a lot of the characters in the show have a bit of an attitude. And
I like that.
Mm-hmm. But still, the ensemble's not quite as engaging as other large cast sports anime have been for me, whereas, like, obviously, Haikyuu is the, you know, standout for everyone in the large cast having a distinct personality and being memorable. And I think Kazetsuyo does well with that too, or Run with the Wind. But I feel like past four characters, I kind of forget who they are. And then there's also knockoff Suga, who just makes me sad because they're not Suga. And I, at this point, will reserve further thoughts until I finish. And, I could be won over. I still will have fun. Sports anime are typically a good time for me, aside from, like, the occasional ones that are not very good.
Just pretend knockoff Suga is Suga.
It's not as pretty.
Oh, I'm sorry. Just like, take a cutout of Suga and, like, follow him around with it.
I like a good face mole.
You do.
Mm-hmm. Then the other show I've watched and finished is Tadakoi, or Tada Never Falls in Love. And I have no notes on this, so bear with me. I ultimately really enjoyed it. It's a cute rom-com. It's very sweet. It's pretty standard fare. Nothing, again, really jumps out as a must-watch by any stretch of the imagination. But it's a good, easy watch if you're just sort of feeling out another rom-com. The plot of that, I have none of the character names written down. I fucked up.
It's fine.
I'll be quick and brief about it then. Ultimately, it's a cute show. Basic premise is the main character, Tada. Honestly, they never really push the, like, I don't fall in love part very much. It's more of he's a photographer and in the photography club and has just never really fallen in love before. There's maybe one episode where his, like, cat, Nyanko Big, whose name I do absolutely remember, sort of marinates on this, as well as the cat has also marinated on his own I've never fallen in love. Which is funny, because I appreciated that plot line in this show, and it may be because I liked the show more, but when, like, the dog fell in love in Blends, I was like, fuck this, like, why do we have to put a heteronormative love on animals? I'm like, you just were fine with it in Tadakoi, Leanne. You just hate Blends.
Well, it's all good that we recognize our own internal biases.
Also, I just really liked Nyanko Big. What a good name for a cat, as I said last week. But ultimately, he falls in love with a girl, Teresa, who's from abroad, from a mythical fake country that I can't remember the fake name of. And obviously, spoiler alert, he falls in love, and so does she. But ultimately, it's sort of all the friends wanting them to get together and trying to, like, help out or recognize them from the sidelines. Mamo's character is the best friend who doesn't get the same strong implied pairings the other characters do. Like, he does and he doesn't. I'm actually very unclear on what they were doing there. Wish I remembered the names. It's unclear on what they're doing there, because it seems like he might be implied paired with one character, but then they bring someone else for her to be implied paired with in later. So he might be more of the Mikurin role, which makes sense because I do love Mikurin, and ended up being my favorite character in this. So I do have a weakness for that role.
God bless.
Yeah, ultimately it's very sweet. You're not gonna, you know, go into it and get just talking about Nozaki-kun, I think that's a show that's particularly special in terms of what it does for the rom-com genre. Ultimately, I would go ahead and say, if you're just picking out an easy popcorn rom-com watch, go into this. But what I will say is that there's just a little bit of humor that I'm like not big on. There's like one joke about a character dressed up in a certain way and then getting arrested, which just doesn't sit well with me. Also, just like the really fucking tired bit of girl with glasses without glasses is beautiful when she takes them off and lets her hair down. What?
Hmm. But glasses are sexy.
Glasses are sexy. And they also never quite, despite being an original work, it felt like that plot line, which I won't get into too much, should have been resolved in a way that wasn't. And I felt like something was missing because of that.
Hmm. Fair enough. I, this week, can talk about Nobunaga Concerto, which I talked about last week as I just watched the first episode before recording. I finished it since. Nobunaga Concerto is a 2014 show that follows the protagonist, Saburo, who is a normal high school student who falls into the past only to discover that he looks exactly like Oda Nobunaga. And ends up taking over his role. And that happens in like the first 4 minutes of the first episode. The show spends little to no time on why he fell into the past, his feelings on falling into the past, his feelings on missing any person that he had in the present or having to change his entire life. In fact, the show is like pretty entirely unsentimental about time travel. I have very conflicted feelings on the show because of this. On the one hand, I thought that like the lighter tone was refreshing for a time travel story. But I also think that it wasn't a time travel story. It was a history lesson, which is fine. Of course, I'm not the target demographic and I don't have, you know, a basis in Japanese history from the Warring States period. And I learned a lot by watching the show and then going and looking up stuff afterwards. But I did feel like watching it without that context, I missed some of the nuance. I also think that either because of budget reasons or just because of plot reasons, they didn't show a lot of the big battles that Nobunaga was supposed to have. Like he would ride off into like the, you know, sunset to go start a big battle with another state. And then the narration would come in and say, and then he fought the battle and he won. You know, overall, I had an okay time with it. It was kind of boring to me because I didn't have the context, but I thought that the VAs did a good job. Mamo is the titular Saburo or Nobunaga. He's fine. He's just your average kid. He doesn't really care much. He grows up as it goes, but none of the characters really get emotional development. I was going to be critical at the beginning of how the women don't get emotional development, but literally none of them do. So it's whatever. Like, literally none of them.
We love that.
Like, I don't think it was the point of the show, and that's fine, but it leaves me with really complicated feelings because I just didn't enjoy that aspect. But the story was just kind of nothing, and it very clearly expected to have a second season, and it didn't get one. Or it hasn't gotten one yet. So the manga is ongoing. Who knows?
Who knows?
Overall, fine. And I started Kimi ni Todoke, which I'm really enjoying so far. I'm like 7 or 8 episodes in to season 1. Mamo's character isn't here yet, but I'm having a grand old time with these like silly high schoolers and their very low stakes problems. It feels like a really nice change after watching a lot of aggressive dramatic shows, especially after watching Code Geass, where like people are out here nuking cities. You know, the kids in Kimi ni Todoke are just having a nice time. Their biggest problems are when they spread rumors or if somebody thinks they're spreading rumors. The titular character, Kuranuma, is lovely and a delight. Her love interest, Kazehaya, is also a delight. The two other friends are both also delights. Everyone's delightful. It is full of delights. And I don't have a full review on it because I'm only a few episodes in, but it's a really nice palate cleanser, and I'm enjoying it. The main crux of the plot so far is that the main girl is being bullied because she looks like the girl from The Ring. She does actually look like the girl from The Ring. and she doesn't help it with some of her antics. But I love that for her. And she's just making friends and having a crush on a boy, and there's really no other plot.
You know what? Sometimes that's nice.
Oh, it is. Like, I feel like I just...
Especially if you're making friends after you look like the girl from The Ring. That part sounds really nice.
It is. I know I just said, you know, I didn't like Nobunaga Concerto because it didn't really feel like it had a plot. Even though I love shows that don't have plots, but I think there's a difference between, like, a war show that doesn't have a plot and, like, a rom-com that's more character-focused that doesn't have a plot.
Right. You can have a slice of life that's focusing on interpersonal relationships, but you can't really have a slice of life that involves time travel.
Exactly. In any case, so that is, yeah, that's all I've got as far as Hot Mamo Summer. I'll be sure to be keeping up with it more this coming week as I've finished Code Geass and I don't really have anything else on my plate that I feel like starting right now. So I anticipate finishing Kimi ni Todoke this week. Though, you know, hold me to that. We'll see. And that brings us to, I think, our larger topic for this week that we kind of have hinted at so far. And it's a discussion I'm really looking forward to having, especially after having just finished Code Geass, which has a really, really large example of this. But let's talk a bit about fridging. And this section will have heavy spoilers for pretty much every show mentioned, just due to the nature of the content we're discussing.
We're going to do our best to name the show before we talk about the characters, and I think we should just hold ourselves to that. But yes, remember, please check our description.
And I think we can also maybe put in a sort of larger content warning for character death.
Right, violence against women and the like.
So let's talk about fridging. First, I think we should take some time to talk about what the term is, what it means, where it comes from. I think you can take the lead on that, Leanne.
So this is a term I understood people had greater familiarity with until I started talking about it and realized that it's not, it sort of was prevalent in certain media circles, but not all. So fridging, or where it comes from specifically, women in refrigerators, originates from a Green Lantern comic wherein he finds that his girlfriend has been murdered and her corpse has been stuffed into his fridge. As a result of a beloved woman's death, the hero, often male, and in this case of fridging, always male, has a newfound sense of purpose and is ignited into performing greater acts of heroism than previously imaginable. It is no longer about the woman who has been murdered, but rather the trauma this places on the man. And therefore, the woman's role becomes no longer active and is now passive, just to kind of propel this man's journey forward.
I think that what makes me excited to have this discussion is the fact that I think we have different understandings of what the term has come to mean. So I know I didn't realize that it wasn't super prevalent either, because I grew up in the kind of nerd circles that, you know, involved a lot of like Buffyverse, Supernatural, like sort of Doctor Who type shows that, you know, share fandom with comics where the term originated, and also have a lot of major character death as part of the story, typically. Characters are just sort of tossed to the side all of the time. So I didn't realize that people weren't as familiar with it either, though I think that's maybe a good thing, and maybe just speaks to differences in media types. I think one thing that, like, the arguments, you know, counter-fridging arguments, is just that women tend to be secondary characters in more superhero stories and in most stories, and the death of a secondary character is often necessary to propel the main character to either do, you know, more heroic things or to go on a greater character journey. But I think that it is more prevalent for women because women are often cast in roles that make them the symbolic innocence of a show. You know, they are mother figures or first loves, or something like that.
I also think it's important that when we look at this too, we see that we often acknowledge that women are more passive in society as like the way they are, at least the way they are depicted in content.
Mm-hmm.
Cis men get to be the ones who play active roles in these stories and in general day-to-day.
Yeah. And this leads to women just being killed off disproportionately.
They're disposable in a lot of these narratives.
Exactly. Maybe the way that we can get at how we differ in our own interpretations of the term is by starting with some examples.
Start with Code Geass, since that kind of inspired.
Yeah, so the reason that I wanted to talk about it this week, and this will be a section that has some spoilers, but minor spoilers, because I really want you to watch this show, Leanne. I don't have any idea if you'd like it.
Well, I think I know who dies, if that helps, so.
Yeah, so I brought this up this week because Code Geass Season 2 has one of the most aggressive fridgings in anime I have ever seen. Literally, halfway through Season 2, a major character is just unceremoniously killed off. She is wonderful. She's a delight. Up until this point, Lelouch's character arc has been very slow, and he's been, you know, going through a lot, but has remained pretty much himself the whole time, which I talked about earlier as, like, a very good thing that the show does. But the death of this character really forces him to take some actions that are, I think, debatably his most questionable in the series, and he goes off the rails a bit for a while. In, like, the very classic, like, revenge, you know, mode kind of deal. But what I found interesting, after I got pissed off about this, because I hadn't been pissed off about fridging in a while, after this, after I kind of moved forward with the plot, the next few episodes had similar circumstances happen to other women, in that women got kidnapped and just disappeared from the plot for a certain amount of time, or had their memories completely erased and became different characters. And it made me start thinking about, like, okay, how do we actually define fridging now? Because that felt fundamentally the same to me. Like, watching as a viewer and as a woman, it felt like the narrative was trying to get all of these women out of the way to motivate Lelouch's character arc. And, like, I did cry. And I love Lelouch dearly, but I was so frustrated with those few episodes in the middle that it was almost difficult to keep watching. That was kind of what inspired this, because I started thinking, you know, this is, like, a very clear example of fridging, but what about these other sort of things that might be fridging in how I feel about them, but don't necessarily fit the textbook definition of the term?
And to kind of give my counter on how I feel about it is, I acknowledge the emotional similarities between the instances of female character dying versus her losing her memory, you know, being injured or what have you. However, I struggle to use the same terminology because I believe in the specifics of fridging being what it is, and that unfortunately just so many shitty things happen to female or non-cis male characters. I would like to call them out specifically in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
But I also understand that emotionally, where you are coming from on this, they do feel emotionally very similar.
Yeah, and I get that. And I think there is a large point to be made about making sure that we name things specifically. But I think that, like, maybe I'm thinking of fridging as an umbrella term for using, like, getting a woman out of the way in a violent manner to motivate a male character arc.
Yeah, and I think I would invert the umbrella.
Fair. We can talk about, like, examples that we agree on and then examples that we disagree on.
Mm-hmm. I'd also like to say something before, is that one of the things that I also am very specific on it, this is because I found a lot of my examples, and I take a lot of the examples differently, because I don't feel like I see fridging quite as much in anime as I've seen it in Western media. And I do want to take a second to acknowledge that I think this is established largely as a Western trope, and we are discussing this within a different context. And I do personally want to be mindful of that as I continue on.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. I think you can name examples of fridging in anime that are inspired directly by, like, Western media, like Cowboy Bebop, which has fridging in its past as a large part of character motivation that doesn't show up until later. And Watanabe is explicit in citing Western influences for the majority of Bebop so that it feels slightly different. But yes, no, like, this comes from a sort of Western comics fandom origin. Yeah, using the term specifically here is not its original context. Maybe we can just talk about some of our favorite and least favorite examples, because I want to talk about Danganronpa. I specifically, Danganronpa's hard, I think, because it's a series of video games. The first one came out in, I want to say, 2009?
I was going to guess 2009, so now I feel pretty confident on that.
Okay, so the first Danganronpa came out in 2009, Don't At Us, is a series of visual novel video games published by Spike Chunsoft that center around murder games in a high school setting, most of them. And so because they're murder games, a lot of characters die. That's how murder works. People are, you know, people die when they are killed. Is that the fate bit? is that the meme? I feel like that's the meme. People die when they are killed.
I have watched Fate and I just can't think of the meme.
That's okay. I think that some of the biggest examples in the Danganronpa series come from the 2016 anime continuation of the first two games called Danganronpa 3. But the first one I want to talk about is actually from the third game in the series, in the main series, Danganronpa V3, where you start out playing as a woman, a wonderful, wonderful girl named Kaede, who is an absolute darling. And you're so excited to start as a woman and play from a woman's perspective in, you know, these like often very male-centered games. And then promptly at the end of the first trial, through a series of circumstances, Kaede is killed. And you take over the reins as Saihara Shuichi, who is the main character for the rest of the series. And his whole character arc is heavily inspired by the loss of, you know, Kaede, who he had a crush on at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And it's upsetting because it is a very textbook example of fridging, in that Kaede represents sort of innocence to him and represents, you know, strength to move on and to gain courage. You know, Shuichi is a very shy character at the beginning and slowly becomes more and more bold throughout each of the chapters.
And of course, they don't try this in any of the other, you know, mainline games. They try it in the first mainline game where a female protagonist is advertised, and it was a really exciting thing to see.
It's true. We got super bait and switched there. But also, straight up in the Danganronpa 3 anime, Kirigiri, who's the secondary main character in the first game, is murdered so that Makoto Naegi, the main character of the first game, can have this like deep traumatic character arc where he like starts to become a leader again and blah blah blah. Except then at the end of it, she's just alive. She's just there again. She like dies on screen, and they give like a half line explanation of why she's back, but at that point I was so annoyed at them for killing her that I didn't care.
See, this is why I feel like fridging in anime isn't quite as real, because I don't believe characters die in anime. They always come back. Except I think there's another Danganronpa 3 example, and to clarify again, it's the 3 anime is different than the V3 game, and then there are 2 anime within that. There is the hope side and the despair side, and there's a character you're introduced to in the despair side, who is their teacher, Chisa, who in the hope side in the first episode is killed, and that helps give Munakata his sort of wild push forward to, and his own personalized justification. I would not call him heroic, but you know, his steps going forward.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually really interesting, because I think thinking about that, I also just thought about Sakakura, Juzo Sakakura, who is also killed for Munakata's character. Juzo Sakakura, one of the very, very, very few, like, outright stated gay Danganronpa characters.
Right, because you have to bury your gaze.
Of course, yes. Different trope.
Right.
Different trope, but similar in execution here.
Mm-hmm.
In that Sakakura, like, has this tragic backstory that's revealed and, like, was super in love with Munakata. And then Munakata, like, he ends up dying slowly, bleeding out in, like, a control room. And Munakata, in the meme bit, like, realizes this is happening and just power walks to him and shows up, like, 5 seconds too late. And I swear to God, Munakata can't fucking run. He's the least goddamn useful character. The only thing he has is a sword, I think. It's been a while since I watched this, but the meme was so prevalent. Because just like give him a segue and he would have showed up like 10 seconds earlier and gotten to hear this love confession and it would have been great.
I totally forgot that meme until you said segue.
They literally just put him on a segue. It's so bad. He just like power walks like nothing's wrong down to the control room where his best friend is dying. And that sort of sets him on the straight and narrow again.
For the record, all three of them are an OT3. I will not be taking further questions.
I agree with that, except I don't care about any of them, and I kind of hate two of them. But they are all dating.
Oh, it doesn't matter how you feel about them. They're just all dating.
That's fair and valid.
They're all kind of bad people.
It's true. There are, I feel like Danganronpa very often has just bad people and good people and few sort of in-betweens. Which is what I actually really liked about V3, because it felt like the characters were in between. That's also not relevant to fridging.
Yeah, we got a lot of things on our list. Let's table Danganronpa.
We'll have a Danganronpa episode at some point. It'll be fine. I know you had some other examples, Leanne, that you felt strongly about, so feel free to go off.
Wow, that's a segue I can't go.
Speaking of segues.
Two more that we agree on. Psychopaths has two, I think, pretty evidently fridged women. If you want to go into the first season, because I remember it not so
well.
That's
fair. I watched Psychopaths a lot more recently. I watched it last fall. And have very like strong good feelings towards it. It's a slightly different example because the fridged character is Akane Tsunemori's what if I said names consistently ever? What if I put them in consistent orders ever? Anyway, Tsunemori Akane's best friend, Yuki, who is just lovely. You see her in a few scenes throughout the first season. She's great and just very kind and like a good friend. She doesn't get a lot of character development because most of the show takes place within like the sort of department and at Akane's work. The Ministry of Public Welfare is what I was looking for. Most of the show takes place within the Ministry of Public Welfare. So you don't get to see much of her until the series' main villain, Shogo Makishima, brutally slits her throat in front of Akane. Just, you know, for kicks, mostly. The narrative uses it as a way to show the villain's sort of unhingedness, how far he's willing to go. And the purpose of her death in the narrative outside of that mostly stands to like shock Akane out of her sort of naivete about the kind of work that she's doing, which I don't think she has very much of it, considering that this show is rated NC-17 and people are getting like blown up by exploding, you know, brain guns like every episode. That's like the whole plot. Yep. But she does die specifically to like cause Akane's character to go through pain and develop sort of more emotional awareness of her situation. And then the second season also has a sort of side character, a female inspector, Aoyanagi, who is wonderful. And I was so excited to see her. And then in the fourth episode, she is tragically killed by one of her enforcers, one of her subordinates, who loved her dearly. And there really isn't too much follow-up on that from what I remember, except that
the problem, right?
Well, yes. She's just sort of tossed out of there to, like, it feels like for shock value again, and right, to cause the enforcer to have some kind of pain, and to cause Ginoza, one of the inspectors that she was close with, to have pain as well.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, I wasn't even, I mean, I was mad about it because I liked her, but Ginoza's pretty when he's in pain.
My God.
Listen, I will be horny for Gino on main. It's fine.
I barely remember Psychopaths season 2. I watched it, I think, in a night a month after it came out or something. So it's a little fuzzy, but I did watch a recap recently before Kim and I watched one of the movies together. I was just shocked, like, how little I remembered about her character, because I think she just kind of disappears after that. She's just entirely disposable.
She just is kind of gone, which is tragic, because she was lovely, and it's incredibly, you know, sexism motivated, but also because anime needs more ladies with short hair. I'm superficial about psychopaths sometimes because I think they're all very pretty. Another one that we somewhat agree on is Full Metal Alchemist. And I was kind of bummed about how often this happens in Full Metal Alchemist.
I know, we want it to be better.
And it is, it's so good. And like, there are so many women, and knowing that it was written by a woman causes me to be a lot more flexible with my interpretation of the narrative.
Me too.
Like, I'm not like, what man did this?
Listen, parents always die.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's true.
It is true. All parents die, except Hohenheim for a long time.
Yeah, but even he kicked the bucket, which we talked about last week, if you want to listen to our last episode.
There's three takes on Fullmetal Alchemist that kind of go about this trope in different ways. So some I say adhere pretty strongly to, and some I say stray a bit, and one is probably just a subversion. I think an example that most people think of first, even when you hear the show, is, you know, they think of Nina and Alexander as well, but Nina's a human, so I'm going to focus on Nina. We see that is how Ed and Al come to terms with sort of understanding the way of the world outside of their own personal bubble and what happened to their mother, but they sort of come to a new understanding about the nature of the military and what it means to be a state alchemist because of this situation.
Mm-hmm.
And we also see it in, and I think there's a question of what does it mean for someone to be fridged in a backstory? You know, I think you can look at the backstory as its own enclosed narrative. It's not quite the same as getting to know a woman throughout the course of a show and then having her just taken away. But there is something said about, you look at a lot of these sad backstories do, and you know why they're like this? Because this woman died. And we do have that with Ed and Al and their mother, which, and then you see it happen again in a pretty tragic way.
For me, the like sort of defining feature of a fridging, you know, what does the, you know, and maybe this is just an example of how effective the trope is, but it's more about like what happens to the man or the main character in the very few times that like characters are fridged for not men. That we can talk all the time about language there and how it just implicates how passive it is because people are being fridged for the purpose of other people. For me, it feels less impactful when it happens in a backstory because you don't watch the male character go on like this sort of emotional arc from it. And I think that like there, you know, there are times like in Full Metal Alchemist where it feels similar because the characters have started their emotional arc after that death and are still on it, whereas there are other examples where the arc happens entirely in the past and it's just something that's sort of mentioned as something that happened that feel less impactful to me because it doesn't feel like it's important to the narrative of the story as we're told it, and therefore I feel less like what man is pulling the strings on this woman, you know?
Well,
and more just like,
would you feel that was 2003, though? Because she is far more prevalent in that.
I mean, like, I'm not saying I don't feel this way with Full Metal Alchemist. I do feel this way with Full Metal Alchemist, that, like, Trisha, like, you see Ed and Al are still on that journey.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, when we see them. Like, they are still very much working through her death, trying to, you know, fix things. I mean, they're not trying to bring Mom back still. They're trying to fix the mess they made by it. But, like, they're still young and they're still learning and still working through the pain that that death caused them. But I think it's different if it was just, like, and also my mom died when I was 5.
Right.
And I think about it sometimes and I'm sad about it, but it's not, like, causing me to grow as a character right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fair.
Characters don't die in anime except that moms do. Sometimes dads do.
It's far more rare.
It's true. I think that that sort of ambiguity in backstory also reminds me of Anohana, which is one that I know we both have kind of complex feelings about.
Yeah.
Or at least I do, but we've talked about it sort of differing. And that, like, the character is already dead at the start of Anohana. Anohana is very much a story about a group of friends reacting to their friend's death. She died when they were very young, and the characters have all been completely stagnant since then. They've been basically frozen in time emotionally, which is like the opposite of what fridging does typically. They're not going on any sort of emotional journey. They're just kind of like grieving in like this endless sorrow and pain, because none of them were given tools to effectively move on, which I think would be a very interesting, would be a completely different discussion if that was the whole point. But it's not, because Menma comes back as a ghost. And her purpose as a ghost, her explicit purpose as a ghost, is to motivate her friends to become better people and to go on an emotional journey. The emotional journey they go on is an incredibly poignant one about, you know, growing up and learning to accept death as it happens and love each other anyway, even through the fear and the pain that that causes. And then she dies again at the end. Like, she dies a second death because her ghost disappears. And I guess I don't really know what my point is there, but it feels like it is both is and is not an example of fridging to me.
Yeah, I struggle to agree fully with that one. I also think that I think that they don't grow after she dies, but I don't think that they don't change. I think because they are ill-equipped to deal with the pain and the trauma, that they do change in a way that is unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
We see them act out or shut in or realign themselves with different people and ultimately separate. There is a change among them because they don't have those tools. Menma's death happens in the past, and it doesn't feel like fridging to me because it's not just about what it does to Jinta or what it does to Yukiatsu. But we see how Menma's death affects Anaru and Tsuruko. And through that, I've struggled to see it as like point blank fridging.
We've talked also about like, you know, examples of fridging that don't specifically involve men necessarily, or like have male characters as like the
I would say on the first psychopaths one, I think she's disposable. I don't know if it's distinct fridging because it is happening to Akane.
Mm-hmm.
I think the combination of everyone being affected, this being in the past, and it not immediately affecting them in the way that fridging typically does, with like the push forward, in a weird way, Menma becomes active again, and she isn't written out of the narrative. She is this major point of the narrative, so she doesn't feel disposable like all these other women. She's in fact the most important person in their lives. So that's why I can't agree with that.
No. I mean, I think I'd agree with that as well. I just think it's a fairly complex sort of example. And maybe, I mean, it's all the better for it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm also just biased because I don't care about Jinta. And he's like very much the main character.
Say Yukiatsu writes.
Yukiatsu writes to get a therapist, am I right?
Yeah. Poor baby.
My poor baby. I mean, I also love all of them dearly, except I don't care about Jinta very much, and I also don't care about Menma very much, unfortunately. And I think that there's maybe a conversation to be had there about, like, yes, she is an active part of the narrative, but she only exists for Jinta. Like, the rest of them can't see her.
Mm-hmm.
For most of it, they don't know she exists, and she pretty much only interacts with him.
Mm-hmm.
And the story takes place inside his head for the majority of it. So maybe there's some sort of complications there. But I would fundamentally agree with your point. I think you've convinced me mostly.
There's also, I think, a distinct pattern in certain film. It happens more, I think, in cinematic anime than it does in TV, where the protagonist or the male protagonist, if the man and woman are co-protagonists, his motivation is to either keep this woman from dying or enrich her life before she dies. It's very much a girl with a terminal illness or a girl fated to die. How am I going to be the one who saves her? And, you know, as much as I think it's a lot of these big, sweeping, emotional tearjerker movies that a lot of us love, but I think that there's an unfortunate pattern in it. And we see that in, I'm going to say the three titles, and that will probably give it away, so do check your things, but Your Name, Weathering With You, and I Want to Eat Your Pancreas. In Your Name, Mitsuha and Taki, right, and the big reveal is that they find out they're from different times, and they even they're going to forget each other, and Taki has to save Mitsuha while enacting her. And while I don't think this falls under fridging, I do think it could, there is a certain amount of why the death of a woman, a potential death of a woman, is more centered than her life in some of these stories.
Mm-hmm.
And with weathering with you, right, Hina has this mythical weather disease thing that is amazing.
God, weathering with you.
But she's going to potentially die for it. And so through anime magic, you know, he saves her and it's all okay. And I want to eat your pancreas. And there are spoilers that happen within the first 5 minutes. You find out that the main female character is going to die because of her. She has a terminal illness. And so all of the connection and conversation between these two characters, this sort of lingers in that as well. So there's this sort of air of death with these women that permeates more loudly than their life does, which I think can be under that umbrella where fridging, I think, resides under as well. I think there's so many cousins.
Fair. Yeah, obviously I haven't seen all of those movies, but I know that when we started talking about this, we were both like, ah, fuck, neither of us have seen Your Lie in April.
None of us officially knows what happens in Your Lie in April, but we have spent enough time analyzing media the way we have that we know what happens in Your Lie in April.
I watched 2 episodes of the show and I know what happens in Your Lie in April.
Yep.
I'm still gonna fucking watch it. I couldn't get over the fact that they only had upper lips. They didn't have lower lips.
Some people have overbites, Kim.
I know, but they all had overbites.
I have an overbite, Kim.
Yeah, but you have a bottom lip that I can see when I look at you, which the characters in this show do not have. I think that, like, also something to be said, we've talked a little bit about, like, gender subversions in fridging.
Mm-hmm.
Or adjacent to fridging.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one thing we skipped over when talking about Full Metal Alchemist is that I think the most textbook fridging example, or would be if the genders differed, is Maes Hughes, in that, like, you get to know him through the narrative. He represents not innocence, but like a sense of comfort and happiness, specifically to Roy. He's very important to Roy. He represents this sort of like support system, this strength, leadership, the same kind of things that I think that like Kaede represents in Danganronpa V3. And at the end of the first act is killed. Doesn't come back. Isn't around anymore. People talk about him, but mostly in passing. The work that he has done is unknown for the majority of the show, and Roy is really upset about it, and a lot of his actions throughout the next few seasons of both series are motivated by the death of his best friend. And so it feels similar to, you know, like a standard quote-unquote fridging to me, in that, except that I wasn't pissed about it because it didn't feel sexist. And also, I was too busy crying.
I struggle to attribute the same terminology when it happens to a man. But I would say it is a definite subversion of it. And one of the things that I think is perhaps even done better narratively than it does with a lot of fridged women is that up to Hughes's death, the actions that he is taking part in are things that will help further the narrative and help. He has figured something out and he has pushed the narrative forward right before his death as well. So that when he does die, it doesn't just feel like Roy is motivated by the sadness and trauma, but that he's actively also furthering the work that Hughes started.
I mean, I would say the same of like Kaede.
Yeah.
I keep going back to her, but I feel like she's I literally just thought about it this as I was talking, but the most sort of direct parallel.
Yeah. And I don't think it doesn't happen. I just think most fridged women are subject to not having much of a plot development aside from their attachment to a man.
Yeah. Like I said, I think this is fridging adjacent. And if we want to talk about fridging and dudes, I could make several Noragami jokes that I would get yelled at by people if I did not reference. But I will not go into detail about because of spoilers.
I also want to look at another potential subversion. And I don't know if I'm using subversion quite right. Cause it may just be more of a shift.
Yeah.
Performing I guess a lot of I was saying functions. I think with men, it's a little bit more of a subversion. I think when it's a woman being treated as disposable to even, or a non-binary person to be treated as disposable, or a gender undisclosed person to be treated as disposable, to give a woman feelings is more of a shift than a subversion, because we're still treating non-cis male characters as disposable. That is something I found a bit more of, and I can just kind of briefly list through them, and I will only get into the ones that are pretty evident early on versus ones that you find out later. So you see this in Yurikuma Arashi, in how Kureha is motivated by Sumika's death and wants to kill the bears. And and even if she doesn't quite understand Sumika's role yet or the bear's role yet, she is on a mission and she has motivation because of that. You see this in first episode of Promised Neverland. So spoiler alert for that, but it's also in the first episode. When Emma and with Norman sees Connie killed. And while I would say this is actively for Emma's sake and not for Norman's sake, is because Emma is motivated by this. Norman is only motivated by Emma. And then you see this sort of in Madoka Magica as well. If you know what I'm talking about, you see this also in Magical Girl Sight. And you also see this in Soul Eater, but it has the subversion of the character isn't actually dead and are magically fine, but he gets this renewed sense of purpose and ability to fight when she thinks her friend is dead.
Yeah. And going off of that into sort of the, I guess this is what I would define more as a like direct subversion, is that like the narrative is trying to make a point off of that death or not death. There are like several, I think, more sort of direct subversions or pieces of media, anime, games that play with this trope, but then don't follow through with it in ways that turn out to be very satisfying. I think one that we both feel very strongly about is the Zero Escape series, mostly in the first game, 9 hours, 9 persons, 9 doors, or more commonly called 999, which the plot of is basically an escape room trying to, you know, get off of a sinking ship story. But as you get further into the game, you realize that it is focusing on the somewhat ambiguous death of a young girl who has grown up into one of the major characters in the game. So there's some interesting dynamics. The character is both present for the entire narrative, but also dead for the entire narrative, because God help me, it wouldn't be a visual novel if we didn't Schrodinger's cat it.
And they will tell you what Schrodinger's cat means in Zero Escape. They will tell you what many things mean.
If you ever want to learn bullshit facts about things that are mostly true, play the Zero Escape games. It literally is like Kotaro Uchikoshi, the creator and writer and director, just read some shit on Wikipedia. The character's name is Akane, and her both death and not death is the central point of tension at the end of the game, where you have to save her. And the whole purpose of the escape room plot has been orchestrated by her to save her own life. So she is in control of the narrative the whole time. She's not the perspective character, but she is the sort of mastermind. And she does this to make sure that she isn't killed, stays alive somewhat.
Let's let a woman who was killed decide that she is not going to be dead anymore and fix her own life post-mortem, kind of.
God bless.
Akane may be the only character who maintains agency throughout the entire series.
It's true. Zero Escape, because it's based off of escape rooms, which the whole thing is that you have your agency taken away from you because you can't fucking leave, means that, you know, none of the characters have agency, except very often Akane. And she's incredible, and we love her. Another series that famously plays with this is Erased, which is a 12-episode anime from 2016 where the main character, Satoru, goes back in time after the death of his mother to save the life of a young girl who was killed when he was 10. They were in the same class. So he has sort of time travel-y type powers that mostly have manifested over, you know, for a few seconds he can go back and stop a tragedy. But this time he goes back over a decade. And the interesting thing about this narrative is that while the sort of impetus for the plot is the death of a woman, both his mother and Kayo, the girl he's going to save, the character who actually ends up erased from the narrative is Satoru himself. As the plot continues, due to, you know, plot reasons, he's put into a coma at the end and ends up in a coma for like 15 years. And all the characters have lived their lives without him and have been motivated by his tragic injury and subsequent coma to take larger steps in their lives, to grow as people, to become doctors and lawyers and help save him and do all of this kind of stuff. So it's a story that plays with the idea of removing a character from the narrative for the benefit of others in multiple ways and on multiple levels. Yeah, I was saying earlier, before this call, in a shock to no one, the show called Erased handles characters being erased from the narrative and what it means to be important to a story. So another major show that I think that I at least have been talking around in this discussion, because I know that it deals with this so much, is Steins Gate and the subsequent prequel, sequel, interquel series, Steins Gate Zero. Steins Gate is based off a visual novel that came out in 2009. The anime came out in 2011. Follows a group of friends who accidentally invent time travel is the non-spoilery plot. Major spoiler alert for all of Steins Gate throughout this bit, because the plot doesn't really, really kick in until episode 12, when Mayuri Okabe, the main character's best friend, is shot in the head, causing him to, for the first time, use their time leap machine to go back and try to prevent her death. He does this constantly. That's like the plot of the rest of the show, is just Mayuri dying and dying and dying constantly. And he does eventually save her. So it's a subversion in the fact that she lives. She makes it out at the end fine, but for a while, it's at the expense of the other main female character, Kirisu, where the sort of...
I just said baby girl.
Yes. Love of our life, Makise Kirisu. Love of Okabe's life, Makise Kirisu.
Fuck that. My life.
Fair. She's wonderful. In the end, Okabe is forced to make the choice between saving Mayuri, his childhood best friend, or saving Kirisu, who has supported him on this agonizing, you know, traumatizing time travel journey. He and Kirisu, because she's also involved in the choice here, decide to kill Kirisu to save Mayuri. Of course, anime is, you know, a sap most of the time. So Kirisu actually lives because of plot reasons. Okabe manages to go back and save her too. And it's a big, big, you know, reveal. And I could talk for 80 years about it. So everyone turns out okay. Everybody lives. Everybody's fine. Okabe has like major PTSD. Some people have had really traumatic things happen to them, but everybody makes it out okay. But I think that Mayuri's death, even though she like is physically present for the entire show because Okabe keeps saving her life over and over again, her personality is sort of taken out of the narrative. She doesn't get a chance to grow the way other characters do. She doesn't get a chance to impact Okabe in any meaningful way outside of being murdered.
Within the context of, you know, Steins Gate classic, Mayuri's attachment to the lab and to Okabe is entirely that, right? Her contributions are that of, you know, she loves Okabe and she wants to spend time with him. The other women in the show or in the game have more direct contributions to the creation of these devices, to the establishment of time travel, to getting the IBN. There is a more concrete reason for them to be there other than her full existence prior to all the death is, I am here for this one person. Like, you could say Daru too, but
But does anyone really care that much about Daru?
Not us.
It's true. Daru, you do some good work, but I think that the show also, like, makes a point to point this out. The game does, I think, more explicitly. But, like, as Mayuri keeps dying, Okabe gets less and less sensitive to her death. And the emotional arc that he takes, while motivated by her death, of course, is one of becoming incredibly desensitized to it and saying, like, you know, I just let her die because I wanted to know what time she died this time. Like, why am I doing this anymore? What is the purpose of me saving her? Like, you know, life is hell and everyone's going to die anyway.
You definitely said, what is the purpose? And I'm going to keep that.
I did say, what is the purpose? Fuck me. She ceases to be a person, both in the sense of the narrative and also to him internally. Although Steins Gate narratively is something that takes place entirely in Okabe's head because of the sort of narrative construction of it. Time travel stories tend to just take place in one person's head because they're time traveling that way. So I have complicated feelings on whether or not Steins Gate successfully, like, actively subverts the trope or just plays into it aggressively.
You have to see it a lot.
Yeah. And the sort of sequel interquel series, Steins Gate Zero, is pretty textbook fridging for the most part, in that it takes place in the timeline where Kurisu is dead. And Okabe's explicit motivation the entire time is to bring Kurisu back, or to sort of take, not revenge for her death, but to, like, become better so that he can eventually go back and fix it. The first, like, half of the show is just him having PTSD and angsting over his dead girlfriend. I'm saying it really casually as if I don't sob over it every time, but that's what it is.
Cry every time you watch the OP.
It's true. They put these shots in there just to cause me, Kim, pain. I feel attacked, personally. But Kurisu's sort of replacement in the sequel series is Amadeus. It's a robot who looks exactly like Kurisu. An AI. And she even gets fridged at the end because she has to sacrifice herself to save the world. All of the characters subsequently forget that she existed, except Okabe. Mm-hmm. Even though, like, her relationship with him was her major one in the show.
Right.
So, I don't know. I have complicated feelings on fridging in Steins Gate because I think you could point to it as a, like, oh, they're making commentary on this thing. And they are, but at the expense of, like, actually doing it.
Right. That's always the question, right? And I think about this when I think about, like, Ikuhara anime a lot, which is, at what point does the commentary feed into what it's speaking out potentially against?
Mm-hmm.
At what point does it try so hard in subverting it, does it just play into it?
Yeah. I think that's pretty clear there.
And now, some terrible anime to recommend to someone new to the medium.
I can start off with my list. First, Otokoi, Love is Hard for Otaku, workplace comedy about otaku. Shockingly enough, the humor relies mostly on knowledge of anime or anime culture. You won't really get the jokes if you haven't watched a fuck ton of anime. Similarly, Mob Psycho 100, while it's lauded as one of the best shows out there, and it's incredible, a lot of the exceptional aspects of it come from its subversion of popular shonen tropes. And if you aren't familiar with those tropes, it will not be as exceptional. And also the animation style is very different from a lot of stuff out there, which can make it less palatable for somebody who hasn't watched much anime, hasn't watched any anime, or their only anime exposure has been, like, Pokemon.
I will disagree on art style. I think perhaps people who don't have exposure to anime are more willing to accept alternative art styles because all anime will be alternative to what they are used to.
I've had people say that, like, who haven't watched much anime say that they won't watch Mob because of the art. I think it's, yeah, they have less of an expectation there. Also, would not recommend Future Diary or Mirai Nikki. I basically wouldn't recommend that show in general, except that I, like, guilty pleasure, really love it. Because I think I love death games, but there is a lot to get past as far as, like, nudity and, like, titty physics and, you know, like, gore and bullshit plot tropes about, like, diaries that are kept on people's cell phones that tell the future. Since this is apparently the episode where I talk about Code Geass. Code Geass is a lot. I wouldn't recommend it to a newcomer, even though it's incredibly, well, it's critically well received. It takes a lot from Ava and relies a lot on popular mech tropes. It's also just sort of excessive in its scale, which can be overwhelming if you haven't watched a lot of anime and are used to just kind of watching more, I don't know. It can be a lot and might get out of hand, or people might roll their eyes or not gloss over the parts that I gloss over. And I think those are the major ones on my list.
So quickly for me, Gekkan Shoujo Nozaki-kun is one of my favorite shows, but as it is about a shoujo manga artist, and a lot of shoujo and romance tropes are deconstructed here. It's not that it wouldn't be good to a newcomer, but a lot would be lost and would make me sad. Anything that focuses on Chunibyo in general, so like Love Chunibyo and other delusions, just because Chunibyo is such a hard concept to kind of wrap your head around if you've never been introduced to it. Even the translation of eighth grade syndrome is a little not quite right, I would say. To watch a show that focuses on it might kill it. I think any Ikuhara anime would be really hard to come in without prior experience. It might just throw you off a little too much. Assassination Classroom, because personally, even though I think there is something worthwhile in it, I had to get myself through season one because it was perhaps too reliant on anime tropes I really do not care for. Maho Shoujo Madoka Magica, because it is the deconstruction of the magical girl genre, and really those tropes and shoujo tropes are required. You're required a prior exposure to magical girl and shoujo tropes to really appreciate it fully.
This has been a really interesting discussion. I'm really glad that we kind of went into this. I know it went long, but hopefully other folks found it interesting as well. And thank you so much for listening. And thank you, Leanne, for, chatting. Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye. Watch Chihaya Furu.